This is a Defocus Media production.
Good day, everyone. Obi Malope here from South Africa, the CEO of Vision Straight, which is a business consulting and management company for the eye care industry. Our role is to play a significant role, add value to optometry practices, ophthalmology practices, any form of business in the eye care industry so that it operates at the highest level of excellence, revenue growth, and transformation. One of the things that we have the privilege of doing is sitting down with incredible leaders from all over the world who are doing extraordinary things within the profession of eye care. And today, we've got one of the most inspiring leaders that you could ever meet. His level of humility, his level of care, his level of passion for the eye care industry, it's unmatched the world over. And that is none other by Dr. Arthur Cummings. How are you today, Doctor?
Oh my goodness, Obi, I'm blown away by your introduction. I've never had an introduction like that. That's amazing. Thank you.
No, Doctor, that was just the starter. I'm actually going to do the actual profile of you right now. Most of the time when we're sitting with guests, we don't actually share their biography in terms of what they have done. We let the guests be the ones to introduce themselves. But as we were preparing for this, two things came to mind that I want to actually share with the audience. Number one, I sent you a message introducing myself because we had been connected on LinkedIn for some time, but we had never had any form of formal engagement. And so I sent you a message to all the people that are listening and watching this. I sent Dr. Cummings a message, and literally 5 hours later, he responded by saying, yes, let's do it. When are you ready? When are you available? That was the first part. The second part was when he signs off on any message that he writes, he does not write Dr. Cummings. He does not write Professor so-and-so. All he writes is regards Arthur. And I was like, wow, the accessibility that you have, how easy it is to approach you, how relatable you are. You don't find a lot of leaders who have achieved the type of success that you have achieved, who have done the type of work that you have done, being so easy to approach or communicate with. And let me give people context. His bio that I'm about to read, he did not even write Dr. Arthur Cummings. He wrote Mr. Arthur Cummings, just to give you context of the level of humility and how easy it is to approach him. It's written here. Dr. Arthur Cummings is by the way, I'm the one adding the doctor part, is a cataract and refractive surgeon at the Wellington Eye Clinic in Dublin, Ireland, participating in clinical studies and serving on the medical advisory boards of numerous ophthalmic companies. A past president of AECOS, and I guess, Doctor, you'll give us the full name of what that stands for in Europe. He is a global ambassador of the Refractive Surgery Alliance. He is the co-chief medical editor of Cataract and Refractive Surgery Today Europe and reviews for numerous journals. He has published over 120 articles in peer-reviewed and trade journals, 12 book chapters, 12 guys, that is like incredible, co-edited 2 textbooks and delivered 450 lectures at international meetings. One day I hope to get to even half of what you have achieved, Doctor. He authored the Wellington nomogram for wave light eczema lasers in 2018, 19, and 20. He was ranked in the top 100 influential ophthalmologists worldwide by the ophthalmologist. Imagine that, top 100 ophthalmologists. He has received numerous awards from the AAO, ISRS, ESCRS, and many, many other awards. He serves on the board of directors of Alcon since the spun-off from Novartis in 2019, April. He is the co-founder, trustee, and board member of the World College of Refractive Surgery and Visual Sciences. Now, when a person that comes with that type of a resume calls himself Arthur, it blows my mind. And let's get right into that, Dr. Arthur Cummings. Who is Dr. Arthur Cummings? How did you enter IK. We want to know more about you.
Obi, I grew up in Pretoria and went to school at a school called Clapham High in Pretoria, co-ed school, met my wife there. We were high school sweethearts. We married 37 years now.
Wow.
And we were conscripted in the army back in those days, and we spent some time in the army. And when we came back from doing basics, because we were young doctors, we were at the military hospital and we were put into different specialties. And my best friend was assigned to ophthalmology and I was assigned to urology. Wow. And I actually really enjoyed urology. It was quite different to other areas we've had any experience with. And I liked the doctor-patient relationship. I liked the array of surgeries. But my friend said to me, my friend working in ophthalmology said to me, take one of your days. We used to get 7 days leave in the first year in the army and 14 days in the second year.
Wow.
This is in the first year where I only had 7 days leave. I was only married for a year. And he said, take one of those days and come spend it in the eye clinic with me. And I said, is this a good idea? And he said, yeah, it's a good idea. You must come do it. And I must say, I spent a day in the eye clinic and I said to him, you're right, I'm going to do this. And it took me a long time to change track and change paths and eventually get onto that track to specialize. But I don't regret it for a day. That was one of those best decisions I'd ever made. It's just such a super space to be in. And it's, you know yourself, you're in the same space. It's just remarkable to be in a position where you can help others live better lives by seeing better. It's a blessing. It's a privilege.
Absolutely. I want to ask you a question. When you look at, by the way, you don't look as old as you don't look as old as you are now sounding, because the minute you talk to someone and they say to you, I was in the army from South Africa, it obviously dates back to over 30 years ago.
Then yes,
we became an ophthalmologist. And so when you look at, obviously you switched specialities from urology to ophthalmology, but when you look at how difficult or easy it was to enter ophthalmology back then compared to the new crop of IK leaders who see ophthalmology as the specialty of choice. When you compare the new breed of IK leaders coming into the ophthalmology space today, whether it be in Ireland or whether it be in South Africa or anywhere in the world, what are some of the similarities or the differences that you can spot that is clearly a differentiator between the two groups?
That's a really good question, and I don't know if I have a good answer. I think the similarities are that it remains a very, very popular specialty. So it's a very hard one to get into. It's a really difficult one to get into. People want to do ophthalmology. That would be the similarity. I think the differences maybe, you know, when I trained under Professor Henny Meyer, we used to start at 5:30 in the morning, 5:30, preparing for the ward round and finish at 7 in the evenings. And then that was the workload. And then afterwards you had to go and study and, you know, get through the academic part of things. So it was really, really hard work. And I do see a difference today, because my son's a young ophthalmologist. He's got another 18 months and then he's finished.
Wow.
It's a 7-year program here in Ireland. And you worked pretty hard too. But if I just look at things generally speaking, I think 30 years ago, we had a different work-life balance. And I think today there's a healthier work-life balance. People are aware that they've got to spend time at work and be productive at work, but that they also need to have, you know, very strong family lives and spend time at home. It's not the whole thing about quality time with children is obviously it's important, but I think quantity plays a role too. And so I think today when I see young ophthalmologists, they're thinking along the lines of what are the hours? How does this look? Where back in my day, you couldn't work enough. You just wanted to work the whole time. So I think that might be a difference.
Are there enough ophthalmologists who have the 30 plus years experience who are available for mentorship? Because your generation, every time you speak to someone of your caliber, of your generation, the first thing that they mention is the hands of the ophthalmologists or the predecessors of the people that trained you and that molded you into the type of leader and eye care specialist that you ended up becoming. Do you find that there is enough? Because now the world is easily accessible. You can talk, I'm in South Africa right now, you sitting in Ireland, I could easily connect with someone in Greece, in Brazil. But with this ease of access to leaders, are leaders of your generation doing enough mentorship? Or are leaders of my generation reaching out to you guys more than your guys' generation were reaching out to the people that came before you? I don't know if you understand.
I do. You make a very good point. I think it's become easier today. But I think what's very interesting about ophthalmology versus refractive surgery is that, you know, the World College that was, it was formed on the 2nd of July last year. And the World College of Refractive Surgery was formed specifically because it's so different to ophthalmology. So that sounds really odd. But, you know, I was talking about my son. He starts his seventh year in July, and then he's in his last year.
Wow.
In all that time, he would have done a lot of cataract surgery, a lot of everything else. He hasn't seen one LASIK, not one smile, not one PRK, hasn't done a trifocal, hasn't done a toric.
Wow.
Doesn't assist dry eye the way we do. So refractive surgery is so different to what general ophthalmology is. Of course, you can't become a refractive surgeon until you've done general ophthalmology. So that's just as far as the work goes. The one is pathology-based and the one's performance-based.
Sure.
So that's another very big difference. And then the ultimate difference is, this is quite a hard thing to get your head around, but here's another one, is medicine in general is around negating loss. So I've lost vision from my cataract. I just want to go back to what I had. I'm losing vision from my glaucoma. I want to stop that getting worse. It's all about insurance. And so medicine resides in public hospitals, in academic hospitals, in private hospitals, and it's insured. We all know we have a risk of certain disease, so we share the cost and we say we're going to insure this, either through tax dollars or through paying medical insurance.
Absolutely.
Where refractive surgery is self-pay. You've just had refractive surgery, so you know, I can use this money for something else. I don't have to do this. My glasses are working pretty well. And so there's an economist who won the Nobel Prize many years ago, called Daniel Kahneman, a behavioral economist. Yeah. A very, very bright guy. And Daniel Kahneman wrote a book called Loss Aversion Theory. He wrote a thesis, Loss Aversion Theory. And it tells us that people value losing something as more important than gaining something else generally. Huh. So you asked something earlier. You asked about, before we got on the call, you said refractive surgery, at what point does this become more ubiquitous? And it becomes more common once the fear element is gone, once affordability improves. Although on affordability, refractive surgery, you'll see over time, Obi, you're not going to believe how much money you save over your lifetime having had refractive surgery. It's very, very good value. There's a cost up front, but there's value on the long term. But so on the performance side, you're pursuing gain. So the best way to get this through, it's a very hard one to explain, but I'm going to try and do it like this with you. Let's say, for argument's sake, you and I are sitting across a table from one another, and I had 1,000 rand in my hand, and I said to you, Obi, we're going to flick a coin. If it's heads, I give you the 1,000 rand, but if it's tails, you give me 1,000 rand. You're going to say no. I'll say, okay, we'll do it again. This time, if it's heads, you give me 1,000, but I'll give you 2,000. And the majority of people still say no. And it's only once you get to around about 4 times, the people start saying, maybe. So once we're flicking a coin, you win, you get 4,000, you lose, you pay me 1,000. The people start thinking that, hey, this sounds like something I might be interested in, which just shows you deep down, we're about protecting what we have, more important than pursuing gain. And vision correction surgery is all about pursuing gain. So it's a different language you speak to people. It's a very different language. The way you speak to people, the way you speak to patients is very different. So your question, I've taken a very long way to get there, but your question about mentorship is, and this is why we started the College of Refractive Surgery,
wow,
is there aren't enough people who are true refractive surgeons around. And the training that people get, it's all been some level of apprenticeship. I don't know many people who've had a similar training in refractive surgery. Everyone goes along a path. It's what I want to do. And they go on their own path of learning where they can and how they can. So the college is all about putting a curriculum together and then accrediting facilities, certifying people and credentialing them. And hopefully we can get more refractive surgeons. And it's also going to have a structure where there are many, many more mentors in that system.
Wow.
So, and it's another passion of mine. I don't know if you've come across this yet. It's not a thing we speak about a huge amount, but I get so upset when I see optometry and ophthalmology positioning themselves at polar opposites when both of us are trying to help patients. That's all we're trying to do. And we should be working together. And there aren't enough ophthalmologists, let alone refractive surgeons. I mean, there's a massive shortage of refractive surgeons given the global burden of vision impairment. So the only way we're going to address this is working with one another, working together.
Wow, that is so, so powerful. You're highlighting so many valuable points that I'm fully convinced that the people that are going to be watching this, they're going to take that information that you've just shared with us and take it deeper into looking at themselves, looking at their business models, looking at their career paths, and actually holding themselves accountable to say, if patients come and they deserve this, how am I then limiting my offering to only this? And if my offering is limited to communicating with them based on my specialty areas of competency, but I know someone else who can take it further, it just gives you that extra added advantage, because that patient becomes your patient for life, whether they've seen the optometrist or the ophthalmologist. For example, I put myself in as that patient. 3 months ago, I was that person whom, after 16 years of spending time with glasses, I then took that decision of going ahead and having refractive surgery. But like you said, it's not like I won't need to see an optometrist for one thing or another at a later stage. So my same optometrist is going to be my optometrist for life. They're just going to be managing me differently. So the cohesion, the relationship that it needs to be taking place, not only between optometrists and ophthalmologists, but taking it a step further between optometrists, ophthalmologists, and refractive surgeons is really, really important, because all three of us play a valuable role in ensuring that that patient that has a need for vision correction, whether it be surgery or any other matters, gets given the necessary information. And even in our books, I've had the privilege of writing and co-authoring a few books. And from the first book to the last book that we wrote, the consistent message is what you've just alluded to now. People look at what will they be gaining if they go with what you're recommending versus what will they be losing if they don't. And I think as eye care leaders, we don't do a good enough job consistently enough in being able to distinguish between the two. Because if we could be distinguishing between the two well enough, the issue will never be about price. The issue will be about the visual benefits, the lifestyle changes that will be involved in that person's life going forward. So thank you very much for unpacking it the way you did. But a question that I have for you is, you come from South Africa, studied in Pretoria. How many years did you work in South Africa before then making the decision for your family to move across to a whole nother country and start practicing ophthalmology in a whole different country, which is Ireland? How did that journey come about? Were you in private care practice in South Africa, or were you in the public space? What was the setup for you here before you made that transition to another country?
So I qualified in 94 and started working in private in Pretoria, at the Pretoria Eye Institute, with a group called Ophthalmicare, and had one session per week on a Monday morning, academically doing retina. Yeah. And while I was in South Africa, I was doing retinal detachments, I did many every single week. And I did cataract surgery, which is sort of the bread and butter of an ophthalmologist. And I was doing a lot of LASIK. So quite disparate. And one of my mentors there was a senior colleague. And he always said to me, you know, you can be a jack of all trades, or you can really try and become a super specialist at one. And I sort of thinking, well, LASIK is easy, cataract surgery is easy, retina is the real thing I'll get into. But then with time, I realized that the only one I'd never spent time on learning more about was refractive. Every year I'd spend some time abroad on retina. I went to Moorfields, went to Nottingham, went to a number of places to sharpen my retinal skills, but on refractive never did. Wow. And then one day I was coming from a clinic in Kroonstad, and I was in the car, And we had a driver, he used to drive us around because we were doing notes and dictating and so on. And I saw this advert for a fellowship in refractive in Dublin.
Wow.
And I thought, you know something? We do a lot of LASIK. We think it's easy, but that's not the right attitude. The moment you think something's easy, you're not paying enough attention to it. You know, the more you learn, the less you know, as you know. So I decided we'll do that. This was all it was. It was just an opportunity to spend time abroad. The family were young. We said, hey, this is great. Let's go and see, experience another experience. We're going for 18 months. And within that 18 months, though, a new laser came to the fore called the Wavelight. And it's just a super laser that changed a whole lot of things. And most lasers today work on the same principles, but it gives you very, very good high quality of vision with not much glare and halos at night, that type of thing. And it had the ability to, in fact, even improve the quality of vision for someone who had pre-existing glare and halos. And I started working with them. They were born around the same time I landed up in Ireland. Wow. And the clinic I joined, he was well-known globally. He was the first eczema laser in Europe he had bought. So the clinic had a good reputation with the industry. And so I started working with Wavelight and really enjoyed that pathway and realized that if I wanted to stay on that pathway and work with industry, I'd have to be in this space. And my wife was working at the University of Pretoria. She was on the cochlear implant program. She really loved her job there. And she said, look, the family is still young enough. We can go back anytime. But as I say, you know, the rest is history. Time, it changes. Before you know it, it feels like the other day. And this year, it's 24 years we're in Ireland. It's bananas.
I can totally understand that. My mother, I was in grade 11 at the time. She said, you know what? Your father and I are not in a good space. He has lost his job. He's not working. Let me go to Saudi Arabia. She was a nurse. Let me go to Saudi Arabia so that I will be able to afford to take you to university in 2 years' time. She only came back 3 months ago. She spent 19 years.
That's amazing. What an amazing story. Jesus.
She spent 19 years in Saudi Arabia. She now knows the language. She knows everything about Saudi Arabia. And now she's adjusting back to life in South Africa, which is a bit difficult for her at the current moment. But I understand where you're coming from when you say, oh, we'll just go there for 2 years. We'll be back. And next thing you know, your children are born that side. Your children are growing up that side. And yeah, wow, what an interesting story. Now, how easy was it for you to settle into Ireland and finding your feet? And because today, you're not seen as an ophthalmologist from South Africa or Ireland. You are seen as a global eye care leader. Now, for you to get into a different country and build your way up, fine-tuning your niche, looking at, I'm going to just spend time focusing and expanding my competency skills and my area of expertise in this particular area. How did that journey unfold for you? What were some of the challenges? What were some of the opportunities that were presenting themselves? And how did you balance the family life dynamics that are in play? Because your wife, obviously, she was also a doctor. She was uprooted now from one country to another, and she now has to build herself into a formidable leader in her space as well. How did that journey unfold as you guys had to now settle into Ireland?
So, Obi, in case I don't tell the story well, there's one thing I'd like to tell your listeners, and that is whenever we're struggling, we think the world's come to an end. But when you look at your journey and you look back, the struggle is what defines you. That's what makes you who you are. That's what gives you what you have and your foundations for the future. So anytime you're struggling should be seen as a time of I'm growing, I'm being challenged, and I'm learning from this.
Yeah.
So yeah, we had lots of challenges. I joined the clinic. We were doing a lot of refractive, nothing else. I was told within a few weeks I'd be doing cataract surgery, but that never manifested. I was blocked from doing cataract surgery for 8 years. If I knew it at that point, would I have stayed? Probably not. But I didn't know. I was always being told within a few months, you'll be allowed into the hospital. So I was blocked. The local community said, no, we have enough cataract surgeons. We don't need you. They didn't care about me being involved in refractive because there were so few people doing refractive. It didn't bother them. But when you started doing cataracts that they might have done, then it was a different story. It's competitive. And around the world, it's like that for ophthalmology. I don't know what it's like in other specialties, but countries and cities are protective of their ophthalmology space. They like to keep other people out. So that was the challenge. The upside was that it meant all I did for those 8 years was refractive. So I dived in very deeply and working closely with industry, really got to understand it very well. The second part that really helped was when I got back to doing cataract surgery, I had sort of forgotten that cataracts were removing this cloudy lens and putting a new lens in. In my mind, they'd always been a refractive procedure. So I was aiming to get the same results we get with LASIK as aiming to get with cataract surgery. And we were doing it not badly for patients who'd never had previous refractive surgery, but patients who'd had previous refractive surgery, our results weren't that great. So it made a colleague and I look at it deeply. We had an idea, we wrote the patents, we got local support here in Ireland from the national agencies, and we built a prototype with one of the universities. And eventually the group that sponsored us said, hey, this looks like it's feasible. You guys can build us out into a company if you want. So we formed a company called ClearSight and did a clinical trial, worked really well. And one of the big corporates acquired ClearSight. And today ClearSight technology is in some of the new devices coming on stream in the next year or two. Wow. So all of those things happen from where you run into a dead end and you think, oh my word, this is the worst thing that could happen to me. But that old saying of one door shuts, another one opens, has never been more true. So we need to create a mindset where being said no, being told no, having doors shut in your face should just be something to reflect on, see how you can navigate this and learn from it. And it's only going to make you stronger. So I know many people starting out in practice feel this is a challenge that I don't know if I'm up for it, but you are. The fact that you've made the decision, you are up for it. And now it's just the case of navigating your way to be the best you can be.
From what I've picked up from all the pearls of wisdom that you've been sharing, you have not been working in isolation. You have not been building your career in isolation from the industry. It's as if you're cognizant of working with other people because it's as if you have an awareness that you bring different skills to what the next person will bring to the table. And one of that example was obviously the World College of Refractive Surgeons. There's a group of you from different countries pulling together in one direction, utilizing your skills, your knowledge, your expertise to elevate refractive surgery on a global stage. Now, what advice would you have to new ophthalmologists who just had an interest in getting into the space of ophthalmology, but they find that it's too expensive, it's too difficult to be able to do the kind of ophthalmology or clinical competency that they would be interested in, based on every industry we know has got gatekeepers of industry. It's not always the case where you'll find that the people, the leaders of previous years, going out of their way to pull up the next generation to take them to another level. So what advice would you have then for young people entering the ophthalmology industry right now globally? What do they need to do in terms of building networks, establishing themselves on a global stage? What can they do to be able to, you know, experience the type of ophthalmology that you perhaps are experiencing or have experienced?
Okay, yeah, that's a super question. You can go on for a day with that one, but it's a very good question. And I think the very first thing you do as a young ophthalmologist, go and show the more senior ophthalmologists in your community that you're interested in. Go and ask them, can I spend an afternoon with you in theater to see how you're doing things? Make yourself available to companies. As you know, on a number of medical advisory boards, and here's a thing which I shouldn't say too loudly, but I sign up to those advisory boards. They want to hear my opinion. That's why they asked me to be on the board. But I sign up to learn from my colleagues. You learn from the experience of others. So it's always a learning experience.
Wow.
And what I can tell you, how many times I've sat on an advisory board and I've listened to the answers and I've thought to myself, we're in an echo chamber. We're all of the same era. We're all in the same situations in relatively well-off countries where we're doing these things. We need a different perspective. We need the perspective of a young person who's starting out. We need the perspective of a person in a different cultural situation. We need a much broader perspective. And so what I want to say to you is, no matter where you are, you have an opinion that has a lot of value. And it's defined ways of getting that opinion out there. There are people who are very interested in hearing what your opinions are, because they've long forgotten what their journey was like. And it's important to know what it's like for someone starting out. And then the last thing I'd probably say, which is maybe slightly counterintuitive or counterproductive, is when you're in an environment like that, where people are giving their opinions at an advisory board, it actually makes sense to listen more than what you speak. So we have two ears, one mouth. We should listen in that ratio and make the point of, when I do say something, I'm not saying it for the sake of saying something. Yeah. I'm saying it because I really have something I want to share. And don't ever think that what you're sharing doesn't have value. People wouldn't invite you to an advisory board if they didn't want your opinion. But when they have an advisory board with 10 people, they want 10 opinions. They want one opinion who dominates the meeting. They want 10 opinions. So I think those would be the key things. But the number one thing would be to show your interest. Just show those who are already on a pathway like this, those who have the connections, those who have industry connections, that you're interested and that you have an opinion that's valuable. And all you need to have an opinion that's valuable is to be authentic. So when you and I have a private discussion, and that discussion sounds the same when you and I are on a podium somewhere speaking at a meeting, now you're authentic. You're not authentic when we're saying something publicly, and behind the scenes we're saying, oh my goodness, that technology doesn't work. What do you think of it?
Wow, that's
powerful. You just said it works. You know, so yeah, you've just got to be authentic. I mean, not being authentic might work for you in the short term. In the long term, it's not going to stand the test of time. You know, you said something earlier on too. You were so gracious and generous with your comments. All of the strong leaders I know globally are people who are authentic, are quiet, are not trying to dominate a room. And you know, we see what's happening in the world today. We see what's happening in Europe at the moment. And that wouldn't happen with an authentic leader who really has the support of the nation and has a senior council that they can take advice from. It happens when people start thinking their own opinion's more important than the rest. And I think it's a good lesson for just making your way in life is be authentic, say something nice whenever you can. If you have to say, that's another thing which is very, very true, is if you're on an advisory board, you're not there to sing the praises of the company. They're there because they want to learn something and they want to learn from people who are giving constructive criticism. So it's the same thing again. Don't say, I love your product if you're not happy with the way it's performing.
Yeah, that is so powerful. And one thing just to add on to what you're saying and picking up from your bio is you never stopped learning along the way. You always put yourself in environments or situations or circumstances where you are bettering yourself from what you knew yesterday. And I think we don't have a lot of people that, I think we've got this tendency as the next generation of wanting quick fixes instead of having that long-term view of, I'm going to be in this profession for the next 50 years. And what legacy, what change, what impact, what influence do I want to have? And you can only start thinking like that when you're not sticking to what you know and not expanding yourself. And one thing that I pick up from your bio is that you've spent a lot of time where no one is looking, putting in the work, putting in the hours that can elevate you to be able to be in the places that you are in right now. So I think a lot of the times people want to get to those environments, not realizing that, wait a minute, there's so much else that you can be doing long before you get to the tables or the environments or the organizations that you want to be in, you know, offering your time to be lecturing, offering your time to train someone else, offering your time to attend a lot of conferences. Here in South Africa this past weekend, there was the OSA weekend. And I get surprised at how there'll be only a handful of ophthalmologists and let alone optometrists who would take the time out to be in those spaces where they're meeting people, learning from other people. And it leads me to the next question. How different is everyday ophthalmology or the eye care industry from an ophthalmologist perspective in Ireland, how far different is it from that in Africa, if I can put it that way?
Yeah, that's another question I'm not particularly good to answer. I've got a very niche practice. My practice is about vision correction, so it's totally geared in that direction. And that, I don't know of too many other practices like that. But I do have a good idea of Irish ophthalmology, especially with my son having coming through the system now and understanding how it works. And I'll tell you what, is medicine in South Africa is typically a very, very high standard. It's a very high standard. You don't have to stand back for anyone. Medicine in South Africa is good. I think from a technology perspective, from an innovative perspective, I think it's high up there too. People are always wanting to learn more. The one thing which I find, I find it disappointing in many ways, is something you mentioned. And somehow you've escaped this. You know, you're young and you've got a learning mindset. You're always on the go. You're always learning, doing more things. And you've got a perspective that normally takes 20 years to develop, but you already have that. So you've learned that somewhere. You can share that with your readers, where you learned that thought process of how to be so inquisitive so quickly. But what I do find is, to a certain extent, and it's equally rife here in Europe as what it is anywhere else, and that is, medicine's a long way. You're normally top of your class or close to the top of your class through school. Then through university, you're doing pretty well. If you eventually become an ophthalmologist, you've done well academically. And by the time you qualify, you figure, I know it all. I know everything. My learning has stopped. And it has to be the biggest mistake you've made of your life. How can you think that for one moment?
Wow.
Yeah. You know, it never changes. You've got to keep on learning. If you don't keep on learning, two things happen. One is you become irrelevant and what you're doing isn't appropriate. And the second thing is, the field you're in, which is such an exciting field, actually becomes boring because there's nothing new. You're just doing the same old, same old, same old. You've got to be doing new things and being exposed to new things to keep it exciting and to keep it viable, viable and vibrant. And so, yeah, I think overall, very good. The public system in Ireland and the public system in South Africa would be all about service. It's about, you know, getting through the workload. I think when I trained in South Africa, a lot of the academic part was sort of left to you. You had work to do. You're going to do the academics. You're going to be doing an exam. Here's what the structure of the exam looks like. Make sure you know these topics. I think that's probably more formal, training looks like in South Africa now versus what training looks like now. So 20 years ago in Ireland, how did that compare? I guess the academic training would be quite formal. It's probably based on a lot of what happens in the UK. And a lot of the training around the world is based on what the UK training program. So, but overall, my sense of South African doctors do not have to stand back for any other doctors, not at all.
What's your biggest, how do I put it this way? You've achieved so much, but when you look back, and everything that you've done, what are you most proud of as a leader, as a human being? What really do you look back and you're like, you know what? This was something else. This was something else. Because I think people that have achieved so much, like what you have done and continue to do so, you still have so much that you want to give back into the industry from what you've been communicating so far. It's very clear that your passion has not died, your inspiration has not died, your enthusiasm, your drive, all of that is still as exciting, as relevant today as it was 30 years ago. But when you look back, what is it that you find that this was something else? This stands out for you more than anything else. For me personally, it's my wife. I think I'm married to the most beautiful person in the whole entire world. And when I look at what this woman has sacrificed to just be in with me and be able to go through everything and do life with me, I'm like, wow, God, I did good here. So what's it for you?
That's fantastic. Because I was thinking about this and I thought to myself, I was going to start off with a sentence, besides my family. But you've okayed that. Yeah, besides my family, that's the thing that I'm the most proud of. I've got a wife who's achieved incredibly. She came here, started her practice from scratch. She's got the top audiology clinic in the country, probably very close to the top in Europe. She's got an amazing audiology clinic, Balance and Hearing. And then my sons have done really well for themselves. They've done well, but the best of all is they're good human beings.
They're
about equity, about fairness, about their integrity is off the charts. I mean, they make me super proud. They put me straight off them. So that would be, but from an academic point of view, my wife's also been a very good grounder, a very good grounder. You know, sometimes you get an award or this or that. And she'd always say to me, your patients don't care about that. They only care about how you treat them.
Wow.
And so on our website, you'll see there's not much about the things we do extracurricularly. It's got nothing to do with the patient. So my biggest thing is changing someone's life. I can see how your life has changed. So Dylan feels so excited and energized by what's happened to you, thanks to his skill set. And I think on a daily basis, that's the thing that makes my difference. That's the thing we've probably got the most control over.
Wow.
I think the other things that have happened along the way, like working with companies and those kinds of things, a huge amount of that comes down to luck, good fortune and timing. And I'm not ignorant of that fact. I'm very aware of how many people have amazing careers that at the end of the day, is in the right place at the right time.
Wow.
You said something very poignant earlier on. You said, you do the preparatory work that when something does happen, you're in a good place to make it happen and to capitalize on it. And yeah, I'm guilty of that. I do a bit of preparatory work. I like to stay abreast of what's happening outside our field too. But I think the key thing is what makes me really happy is the effect and the life changes we bring about in our patients on a daily basis. That's the part that really gives me life satisfaction.
Wow, wow. Dr. Cummings, I think we should leave it at that note. Wow. I'm excited for the feedback that we're going to be getting from people that are going to be watching this. Thank you very much for unveiling yourself. You inspire me. You literally inspire me because you saying to me, it's possible for people from anywhere in the world to make it anywhere in the world and operate at the very high level. For me, that's been my biggest challenge for me to say, I don't want to be known as this person who's doing this in South Africa. I want to do stuff and change and make an impact to ICAP businesses the world over. And it's people that have come before me, like yourselves, who have paved the way, who I can look at and say, okay, this is the pathway that Dr. Cummings went through. These are the challenges. This is what he had to do to overcome it. This is the discipline. This is the work ethic. This is the attitude. This is the integrity. This is all these other things that perhaps are not seen in public platforms, but are happening behind the person that we are now looking at and marveling. So thank you for setting the pace, setting the tone, being the example that many leaders who are coming after you can be able to say, pass the baton to us. We will go further than you. So thank you so much for unveiling yourself. This was absolutely phenomenal. I'm super, super excited. And I can't wait to meet you in person, to meet your son in person, to meet your family in person, and to visit Ireland very, very soon. Because if this is what I'm getting from you on an online platform, I could only imagine what will happen if I'm in your working in space. So thank you very much for today. God bless. All the best for the next coming years. You are truly a champion for iCare excellence. And thank you for this.
Hey, Obi, it's been such a pleasure and privilege. I'm energized by you. I mean, you're achieving so much in your young career. And I love the way that you're thinking globally, but you're still thinking locally too. And I really appreciate the privilege and opportunity. Thank you very, very much.
Everyone, where can people connect with you, Dr. Cummings? Any website that...
A very good place is LinkedIn. LinkedIn's a super place to do it. I'll be really happy to hook up with anyone on LinkedIn.
Absolutely, absolutely. Everyone, thank you yet again. If you're not subscribed to the Vision Straight YouTube channel, if you're not connected with us on the different social media platforms, make sure you do so. And like Dr. Cummings has said right now, LinkedIn for professionals, it's absolutely amazing. That's where him and I connected. So we would love to connect with you and watch out for the next masterclass series episode that we're going to be running and doing with another great phenomenal leader. Until then, take care, stay blessed, and everything that you do, make it count. Take care, everyone.